It's just past the autumnal equinox, and now the days are shorter than the nights, and the infallible signs of approaching winter are all around us. Still, this season does offer the joys of fall, and here in the north, the harvest, the turning leaves, and the departing birds. Here's Mary McCann with our bird note.
In September, Arctic terns fly south over the ocean from Alaska all the way to Antarctica. Also in September, the last rufous hummingbirds depart their breeding range in the west, following floral highways of mountain wildflowers south to Mexico. Ruby-crowned kinglets are leaving the northern evergreen forests where they nest on their way to milder climates. Each of these birds is migrating, but on a very different course. All have the same adaptive goal, making the most of food and breeding opportunities that change with the seasons. Arctic terns follow one of the longest annual migrations, traveling as much as 44,000 miles each year. Arctic tundra provides their ideal nesting site in summer. The Antarctic, the ideal feeding grounds in our winter. Rufous hummingbirds are medium-range migrants, traversing about 5,000 miles a year between temperate and tropical nectar sources. Some ruby-crowned kinglets are altitudinal migrants, especially in the west. They may remain close to the same latitude all year, but spend the cold months in the relative warmth of the lowlands, dining on insects and their eggs. In summer, you'll need to ascend thousands of feet into the western mountain ranges to hear the kinglet's exuberant song. I'm Mary McCann.
To find some photos, migrate over to our website, loe.org. In early 2011, the Keystone XL pipeline project to bring tar sands crude from Canada to refineries on the U.S. Gulf Coast seemed almost certain to be approved by the State Department and the White House. Now that approval's no longer quite such a slam dunk, and part of what's changed the equation are protests organized by 350.org. In all, more than 1,000 people opposed to the project were arrested on the steps of the White House in the fall of 2011, setting off a fierce national debate on climate change. Among those arrested was Bill McKibben, a co-founder of 350.org. His new book, Oil and Honey, is part memoir of the life of a climate activist and part meditation on beekeeping in Vermont. Bill, welcome back to Living on Earth.
Steve, as always, it's awfully good to be with you.
So, Oil and Honey, kind of a biblical reference. What's this book all about?
Well, I mean, I suppose it's a title that works in a lot of ways. It either calls up those biblical ideas of milk and honey or the idea of oil and water not mixing or whatever. But it's about the global and the local. The oil stands for the global problem into which we've fallen, the greatest problem humans have ever faced. The honey and the story about the beekeeper in Vermont that underlies that half of the book reminds us that it's possible to imagine a different world, and that that world is the one that we need to head toward. The reason that we have to head off the climate crisis is so that we can produce the kind of planet that works for people and works for the rest of creation, too.
This book is a delight to read, and it's, well, much more personal than your other books, although you did write about having just one child, having only one. This is really a memoir about your personal transformation from Bill McKibben, the environmental writer, to Bill McKibben, the rabble-rousing, getting-arrested activist. At what point did you decide that being a commentator about climate issues just wasn't going to cut it anymore?
You know, I wrote the first book about global warming 25 years ago now, The End of Nature. And at the time, I think I, and probably most people, thought this is an argument about reason and science, and that as that science becomes clear to everybody, well, then change will follow, that our leaders will do what's necessary. And for year after year, scientists trotted up to Capitol Hill and explained that the worst thing that ever happened was happening, and economists came right behind them and said, it's pretty clear what we need to do. We put a price on carbon to reflect the damage it does in the atmosphere. We internalize the externalities. We won the scientific and economic arguments powerfully. We just weren't winning any action. We were losing the war. And at a certain point, I think, a bunch of us realized this isn't all about reason. It's mostly about the incredible power of the fossil fuel industry. They're the richest industry on Earth. I mean, Exxon made more money the last 4 years than any company in the history of money, okay? And that if we were going to take them on, it wasn't enough to just win the scientific argument. To write some more books did not seem like it was going to substantially contribute to this. We needed to build a movement that could find a different currency than money to work in. The currencies of movement, you know, passion, spirit, creativity. Sometimes we'd need to spend our bodies.
One of the gifts of your book, Bill, is that you take us inside this massive demonstration in 2011. Really several days of demonstration action in Washington where you and a number of prominent people get arrested, including Gus Speth, who used to run the Presidential Council on Environmental Quality, a guy with a White House pass, gets arrested in front of the White House. Tell us how that all came about.
Well, we'd sent out a letter, Gus and myself and Wendell Berry and some others, asking people to come to Washington and get arrested at the start of this protest over the Keystone Pipeline. And we did not know if anyone would show up, but a lot of people showed up. Even on the first day of this planned two-week thing, there were about 100 people there to get arrested. So the police decided they'd try to deter us by treating us somewhat more harshly than they normally do, protesters. So the first wave of us got to spend 3 days in Central Cell Block in D.C., which is about as much fun as it sounds like it would be. But the great pleasure was having Gus in the next cell. Through the bars, and we could talk. In fact, he shouted out a half-hour synopsis of his new book, America the Possible, to the whole cell block, all the other protesters who were there. We had a kind of, you know, jailhouse school, you know. I remember at one point they weren't letting us out to see lawyers or anything, but Gus Speth's son was a big, heavy-duty corporate lawyer in D.C., and he'd been papering the jailhouse with writs, I think, and things. And they finally let Gus out to see his son for a few minutes. And we knew that was our chance to send a message to the press, so we tried to think what Gus could say. And he just wrote out this one sentence. You're right. He'd been head of the Council on Environmental Quality, head of the UN Development Program. He pretty much as heavy a hitter as there's ever been. And the one sentence he wrote was, I've held a lot of important positions in this town, but none of them seem as important as the one I'm in right now, which I thought was a pretty powerful way to explain why movements really are what underwrites all the other environmental policy and investigation and things that we engage in.
So 3 nights in jail, and not just any jail, but, you know, D.C., downtown, pretty nasty place. I mean, one has to think it's D.C. that the White House would have had some influence over this decision.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I frankly kind of doubt it. I bet they weren't paying that much attention, at least at the beginning. But they're paying attention now. Keystone's become the iconic environmental fight of our time. And sometime this year or next, the president's going to have to make the call. And when he does, I mean, it'll be an interesting moment. If he does the right thing and blocks it, it'll be the first time that any world leader has ever said no to a big project on the grounds that it would be bad for the climate. If he says yes, you know, I fear that we'll have no choice but to think of him as, at least on this issue, big talk, small action.
Bill, you could have easily chosen just to write a memoir exclusively about your work with 350.org, but it's called Oil and Honey, and you spend an awful lot of time writing about your friend who's running an apiary, a bee business there in the Champlain Valley of Vermont. Why was it important to tell us about you and your friend's relationship with honey?
Well, first of all, this guy is a great character, Kirk Webster, first chemical-free commercial apiarist in the country. Thrived his hives thriving despite the horrible things that are happening to honeybees, as you know, across this planet. And so I wanted to tell his story. But the more that I sort of thought about it, the more it was clear to me that this was the other half of the story that needed telling. We need to do two things. We need to make our local places work again, to be able to be more self-reliant, to not depend on, you know, supply lines that stretch out forever into the world, but relocalize much of our lives. There's no way to break the fossil fuel habit without doing some of that. And that's why it's beautiful to watch these things happen. And I love to describe the time with the bees and things. By the same token, if that's all we do, then it won't work. There we were in Vermont in 2011 in beautiful bucolic Vermont when Hurricane Irene came up the East Coast and passed over record warm waters off New York and New Jersey and soaked up immense amounts of rainfall and shattered every record that we had in Vermont for how much rain, and it just washed away not just roads and bridges, it washed away a lot of the beautiful organic farms. We got to do both these things, local, global, home, and away.
One of the things that you note about bees is their decision-making. You say this is a form of consensus.
This fascinating book about a year old by a Cornell entomologist named Tom Seeley. And his question was, how do bees, you know, bees swarm in the spring. If they get too many in a hive, half the hive will go off and find a new home. And you've seen them sometimes, big colonies of bees hanging from a light post or a tree. Mm-hmm. As they're waiting for 48 hours maybe to figure out where their new home will be. It's not that the queen goes and makes a decision. Just the opposite. She's a bystander. When that swarm emerges, hundreds of scouts go off in every direction, and they find suitable sized holes in trees or under eaves or things. And then they come back to the swarm, and they tell the story. They do it by dancing to sort of describe the place they found and where it is. And the ferocity of their dance indicates how good a place they think it is. So if they're really, you know, if it's like serious, like Soul Train, you know, getting down, then a lot of other bees start paying attention. Some of them go off and look at that hive, and they come back, and if they agree, they'll dance enthusiastically. There'll be six or seven contenders at first, and then more and more bees will go and stand in one corner, as it were. When you get to about 60 or 70%, the whole thing just tips, and everybody agrees, and they fly off together. So it's a lot like New England town meeting, you know. It's very direct democracy. And as far as one can tell, uncontaminated by, I mean, there's no bees like buying off other bees, you know, in order to get things to go their way. So yes, a useful reminder of what a more direct form of democracy looks like.
Okay, Bill, when you began 350.org, it seemed that you were really focused on the political process, going after politicians to make a change. When did you decide to just aim straight at the oil companies?
Well, because we figured out that the politicians were not independent actors in this case. I mean, we've watched the Keystone thing. We can predict with unerring accuracy how politicians, how congressmen will vote. If you tell me how much money they took from the fossil fuel industry, I can tell you how they'll vote on virtually anything related to the energy industry. So we really began to understand that these guys were the problem. And it's why we'll play defense with things like Keystone, but why we now try to play offense as hard as we can, especially with this divestment campaign that's burgeoning around the country and very exciting to me.
Let's talk about divestment. You've been out there fighting against Keystone, but now you've moved into this realm of asking folks to divest of their investments in fossil fuels.
Focused first of all on institutions, on colleges, universities, churches, cities. We started about 10 months ago modeling ourselves really on the work that was done around apartheid in South Africa a generation ago. And it was Desmond Tutu, who played such a role in that fight, that recorded the seminal video for this. He just said, if you could see what drought and famine were doing to Africa through no fault of our own, you'd understand why we need you to take up these same tools again. So far, beginner's luck, we're ahead of the pace of, say, the work on South Africa. 15 or 16 big cities have already divested: Seattle, San Francisco, Portland, Providence, Rhode Island. Six or seven colleges have already done so, most recently San Francisco State. This summer, big religious denominations, the Unitarians said they're going to spend a year in a process of discernment about whether to divest. The United Church of Christ heard more directly from the Almighty and decided to divest right away. They're our oldest, you know, denomination. They're sort of the ones that date back right to the Pilgrims. And they said it's not okay to be paying our pastors by investing in companies that are running Genesis in reverse, you know. This is spreading around the world. The Uniting Church of Australia, the Episcopal Diocese of Auckland in New Zealand this week, colleges and universities in Europe, in many parts of the planet, people taking on this industry as forthrightly as they can.
What's the logic of divestment?
It's not that we're going to bankrupt Exxon. We're not. But we're going to politically bankrupt them, morally bankrupt them, make it hard, turn them into the rogue industry that they deserve to be. The math is pretty simple. If you go look at all the SEC filings and annual reports and things, the industry and the countries that kind of operate like fossil fuel companies have 5 times as much coal and gas and oil in their reserves as even the most conservative scientist thinks would be safe to burn. 5 times what would take us past a 2-degree rise in temperature. But they're going to burn it. That's what they've told the banks. That's what they've told their investors. They've found this coal and gas and oil. They plan to dig it up and sell it. In fact, they look for more every day. Exxon boasts about spending $100 million a day searching for more hydrocarbons, even though we have already melted the Arctic, you know. In fact, the minute we melted the Arctic, their first response was, let's go up there and drill for some more stuff.
But they don't burn it, though. We burn it.
Well, that's right. But most of us, day by day, we have some choice about how much we burn, and I trust that everybody who listens to Living on Earth has long since changed their light bulbs and changed their lifestyles to one degree or another. But there are limits to how much one can fully escape the fossil fuel world. You know, you might want to take the train, but if there is no train, it's hard to do. And the reason that there's no train is because the fossil fuel industry has made sure that they've protected their racket for a long time. They're the only industry on the planet that's allowed to pour out their waste for free. Nobody else ever, anywhere, gets to pollute for free. That's a privilege reserved for these guys. As long as they're able to hold on to that, the chances of the deep structural change that we need are hard to come by.
So, subtitle of your book, Oil and Honey, is The Education of an Unlikely Activist. What do you think you've learned most on this trail?
It's a good question. I think I've learned most how many people there are who want to do something. The problem with taking action on climate change is that it seems too big, that the problem is just so huge that nothing any of us could do as individuals could matter. And in a way, that's true. I mean, I've got all the right light bulbs in my house and solar panels all over the roof, but I try not to confuse myself with the idea that that's how we're going to solve this problem. We're going to solve it if we come together as a movement, and I think people realize that more and more all the time. If the problem is structural, then the solution has to be a joint solution that changes the balance of power. So I suppose in some ways that makes us radical. But in other ways, just the opposite. All we're asking for is a planet that works the way that the planet worked for a very long time, for the 10,000 years that is the sum total of human history, you know. Asking for that kind of stability isn't radical. If anything, it's conservative. I think in the end, radicals work at oil companies. If you're willing to make your fortune by altering the chemical composition of the atmosphere, if you're willing to make your fortune by raising the temperature of the earth, then you're engaged in the most radical act that any human being's ever been engaged in. And it's time for us to check that radicalism.
Bill McKibben is a writer, distinguished scholar at Middlebury College, and the progenitor of the organization 350.org. His new book is called Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. Thanks for taking the time today, Bill.
Pleasure as always, friend.
And there's much more of this interview at our website, loe.org.